The debate should not be based on politics. It should be based on a sound understanding of the biology of a product.
Welcome to Wine and Health, a new podcast channel from Drinks Insider. In this occasional series, I'm going to do a deep dive into wine, health and health policy. What do we know for certain and what don't we know? And how is this information being used? Come on this journey into a world where evidence, uncertainty and public health collide. For centuries, winemakers have used everything from egg whites to fish bladders to sulfites to help the winemaking process. But this has come as a shock to many wine lovers who've discovered there's more to wine than just crushed and fermented grapes. More and more entrants to the market are claiming their wines are clean and free of such things and accuse their competitors of adulterating their wines with weird chemicals. This has become a big issue. Karina Stockley always sighs when I talk to her about this. She's an expert in pharmacology and toxicology who's been at the forefront of international winemaking policy, making decisions about allergens, additives and processing aids. And she probably knows more about this issue than anyone else on planet Earth. We didn't get through the full list of additives and processing aids because Karina is also the co-founder of a group of doctors and scientists called the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research. That means she has a unique insight into some of the contentious debates currently going on about how much alcohol is safe to drink. So we had a lot to talk about, as you'll hear. Hi, Karina. Great to see you.
Ah, lovely to see you too, Felicity.
So I'm here today. Everybody wants to know about additives in wine. When I told people I was going to be speaking to you, I had everybody produce their favourite additive they wanted me to ask you about. So first of all, what is your background and how are you? How did you come to be an expert in this field?
Okay, my background is clinical pharmacology and physiology. So at university I learned about chemicals and how they affect the body. So that was my specialty. But part of pharmacology is toxicology. So after I left university and I'd done research in universities, I joined the wine industry. And one of the first roles, because of my toxicology background and understanding of how chemicals affect the human body, is that I got involved with a significant revision of the Food Standards Code for winemaking, not just nationally in Australia, but internationally with the OIV. So it was sort of a bit of a baptism of fire because I didn't know a lot about winemaking at the stage and I sort of, you know, hit the ground running. But yes, I've had a lot of work to do with the Australian government trying to ensure that it was purely health and safety based, and the same with international regulations, so that they weren't technical barriers to trade, that they were actually based on sound science. So that's where my jobs come in.
So how does it work internationally? Is it done country by country or is there an international standard? And if so, how do you get something approved internationally?
It's interesting, is the best way, and it's complicated. Nothing is ever straightforward. Because
you surprise me.
No, you've got the traditional. You've got the European model, which is the Food Codex Alimentarius, and you've got the OIV. So you've got an international model, but they don't necessarily set recommendations rather than carte blanche limits. So the limits are then set by either the OIV that then work in context when the Office Organisation International de la Vigne et du Vin is the OIV to give its full title. So they will work to look at different additives and processing aids. There's a 7-step process that they have to go through to demonstrate safety and applicability. And then from there, once all member states vote. So it's everybody's got to be happy. You don't get something through, and it can take, you know, more than 7 years to get something through.
Where do these come from? Does some company go, wow, here's this really great idea, and then they put it through for testing and registration, or is it the other way around that the OIV says we need something, somebody go and develop it?
it's often, it's companies finding things. So a lot of the stuff is traditional. It's come, you know, come up. The OIV has been going over 100 years. So it's come up through the bottom. That we had things that were already in winemaking practice and we needed to put some, potentially some safety limits when safety became a big issue. Through the last couple of decades in particular, so safety became a big issue. So we started to put limits and try to understand health and safety for consumers. We have a positive list pretty much of additives and processing aids that you're allowed to add. You just can't say, hey, I've got this wonderful new product. I'm going to use this in winemaking and then and automatically be able to sell it into the marketplace. It doesn't work like that. You've actually got to demonstrate that the health and safety aspects, and then you've also got to look at the purpose. Is it a unique product? Is it going to do something better than another product in the marketplace or replace a product in the marketplace? Is it more or less effective? You've got to go through the health and safety data and then you've got to go through the, well, what's it going to add to this? You know, so you just don't have a huge list of, oh, well, these things all work and therefore we can use them. So it's quite a tight list. And for the OIV, once they've accepted something, and the OIV has more than 46 member states. Now, those member states don't have to adopt what the OIV says, but the EU then takes that and puts it into EU law for the European Union countries. And then to ensure that we don't have technical barriers to trade because we have differences in our laws and acceptability of additives and processing aids, then each country's regulations will then look to adopt, if they haven't already, that additive or processing aid. Sometimes it's done in tandem and sometimes it's done at the same time, simultaneously.
What's the difference between an additive and a processing aid?
Okay. An additive is something that remains in the product. A processing aid is something that's used and then is removed.
Okay. So here are some of the things that people said when I said I was going to speak to you. They say, surely if you grow the grapes properly, you shouldn't need to use any of this stuff. What do you think?
In a perfect world, but it's not a perfect environment for growing grapes and the environment changes every year. So you have a lot of inclement weather conditions that will modify aspects. You may not have enough sunshine. You may have harvesting issues. There are so many things that can go wrong, not just viticulturally, but then once it gets into the winery. So a lot of this is to reduce bacterial spoilage and growth, to make sure that we, you know, have a sound product that doesn't cause off flavours or other potential problems. So additives are also there to balance what's happening with your wines. You can, as I said, depending on the season, the growing season, you can have excess sugars or excess acidity. So you're looking for a balanced product that you want to be able to balance up so that you can then go forwards with the wine and do other treatments. You may want to stop some other bacterial issues that could come in the fermentation process. You might get something what's called a stuck fermentation that you might need to encourage the fermentation because of the temperature that may be in the winery environment or whatever else. There are so many different issues around. You just want to encourage the process to go and make it the best product that you can within the bounds of the grapes. So, yes, the grapes set the standard to start with. You can't make bad wine out of bad grapes, a good wine out of bad grapes, but you can ensure that a good grape, the best is made possible in the wine.
And how do we know that these things are safe?
Because they're not allowed to be used in winemaking until they're proven. So you will go through animal studies and then you will go through human studies. There's a Codex Alimentarius Commission that I worked with to get a couple additives and processing aids accepted by them, and it is such an onerous task to look at the animal toxicology. You name it, they want to know about it. So the dossiers that you end up writing could be something like 50-page dossiers with all the relevant health and safety, the toxicology, the animal, then the human toxicology. So you go animal, test tube data, okay, so you're taking human substances and putting them in a test tube, and then you look at the data that's actually been done in humans. Clinical studies to look at, you will look at normal toxicology, but you'll also look at cancer risk and other risks. So it is such a strenuous process. FSANS in Australia, Food Stamps Australia, New Zealand have a very, you'll have a product, and when you need to put it through FSANS, for example, they'll say, okay, what's your international data? So you have the international data. And then they'll say, well, the international data is very useful, but we want to know what's happening nationally. Can you do some winemaking trials to see if we're actually going to get the same levels in Australian wine with some of the different procedures that we might have? So just because there's something approved in some parts of the world doesn't mean that a country would automatically accept it in their own country unless they have a trade agreement to say that they will recognise each other's food safety standards.
So what about all of these when they are working in concert? How do you know that when additives are, you have multiple additives, that they're fine for human health?
They can't be used unless you've done your toxicologies.
Right.
And we also have auditing processes, particularly in Australia. We have an auditing process. And the US as well have strong processes at looking at the winemaking. So when you have a wine that goes into the marketplace, you have a lot of checks and balances, to a checklist of what's acceptable and what's not. And similarly around the world, you just can't put something on the marketplace. You've got to actually prove that it complies with all the regulations. It's met everything.
We had a conversation about this a few years ago, and I remember you telling me that there may even be less additives on the market than there were in the past,
Absolutely.
That is so interesting. So why is that?
Because if they're not used and they've been superseded by something else, we simply remove them. They're not needed. So the list becomes smaller. So if you've got a new product additive or processing aid that's coming through that is so much better than what's there now, everyone's going to use the new one and not the old one. So the old one will eventually be taken off when you can prove that so few people use it. So it is really a tight list.
Do you think also it could be a symptom of the fact that grape growing is getting better as knowledge spreads?
Look, there's so many ifs and buts in grape growing.
Right.
There's so seasonal variation. It's so hard. I wouldn't say it's improving. I think methodology may be improving or changing, but I wouldn't say grape growing itself is improving. I know people are trying different methods, but I wouldn't say that's an improvement.
So I think, as you're probably more than aware, these additives are used by some sections of the wine community as a stick to beat the other sections of the wine community. So I want to go through some of the more controversial additives, the ones that are always coming up in disparagement marketing, and perhaps if you could tell me about them. Okay, so the one that comes up a lot is PVPP. I'm going to give the acronym, the initials, not try and say it. It's polyvinyl
pyrrolidine, yes.
Yes, so could you explain what that is and why we use it?
Okay, right. Well, I'm probably not the bestest person to talk about PVPP, but it is a fining agent. It has been around for many, many years there. People often get it muddled up with PVP, which does have some toxicological issues, but it is a proven product in the marketplace.
Am I right in thinking it's a binding agent?
Yes, I think that would be the best way to describe it, because you have to remember that I am not a winemaker here, but yes.
Well, that's good, because neither am I. So Okay, so let's move along for that one. Velcorin is one that comes up.
Yeah, DMDC, that's also one that's been around before. It used to be confused with DMDE, which is toxicologically not acceptable in the marketplace and does have some issues. So people often will look at DMDC versus the ethyl toxicology and be concerned. But no, that's another. So winemakers will choose different additives and processing aids because of how the wine may be finished or how they react with certain product. So, you know, winemakers are given a choice in what they use, and the choice will depend pretty much on the raw material that they've got to work with as to what, how much they need, whatever else.
Okay, so one that also comes up is isinglass or fish bladders. This is used a lot by people to say, isn't this hideous? There's fish bladders in wine. No. Can you tell me about isinglass?
Isinglass, it's a processing aid. Like the other ones, they're all removed from wine. The DMDC, the PVPP and the isinglass are all removed from wine. Yeah, traditionally from fish bladders. There was a lot of hoo-ha when allergenicity came into play, and we looked at potential adverse reactions from, you know, eggs, milk, fish, whatever else, fining agents in wine. But it doesn't remain in the final product. And also the icing or isinglass, however you like to pronounce it, is so refined. There aren't allergenic particles present in it. And this is what we've actually been able to show by doing very good allergenicity studies, so much so that it doesn't have to be labeled.
Now this is a very old winemaking technique.
Yes.
Do you know how old it is and why it was used to start with?
I think it's more a traditional one. It's been used in the brewing industry as well. So it's just one of those very old ones. I can't tell you how old, where it came from, but it has been around for a very, very long time. And I mean decades and decades and decades, if not even longer. It may have been in a different form. It may have well been used in a different food making process. But definitely the beer and the wine industry have used it for a very, very long time.
Okay. Why do we use enzymes?
To facilitate chemical processes within the wine, basically, to either facilitate fermentation, whether it be malolactic fermentation or related to straight fermentation. Enzymes will be used if necessary. You're not going to use an additive or processing aid if you don't need to use it, because you don't want to inadvertently do something you don't need to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting thing that actually people try and avoid using them if they can because they don't want the added cost. So how likely is it that even the most, commercial winemaker is using multiple additives in winemaking?
It's unlikely. You use only what is needed. So you're not going to add unnecessarily. You're right, cost is a factor, but also you don't want to inadvertently do something that's unnecessary. And you want to keep your product as what we'd say, as clean as possible.
Yeah, it's funny. I've got a friend of mine who grew up in Burgundy, and she said one of the things that you learn growing up in Burgundy, or she did learn, was how to buy sugar from the supermarket in such a way that the authorities the authorities won't get you for bringing it back to your winery and adding it to the wine. That this idea that traditional winemaking has always been free of any kind of intervention is false.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is total furphy. It's always been there, whether it's up front or behind the scenes. There's often a lot going on.
Am I right in thinking that at one stage people could use blood as a processing? What happened to that?
Well, that when I first started in the industry in 1990, 1991, the French were using blood products as finding agents. That was removed probably by about 1993, 1994. It was removed because of the potential issues with blood products that were starting to become realised. So, that was very quickly moved off. The approval list. That was one of the most contentious, and I think people would be horrified. It was never approved in Australia and the States, but it was very much old tradition from Europe. So a lot of these did come from old tradition in Europe, and this is why it is so hard sometimes to work out where they actually started from, because it goes back so far and may well be related to another foodstuff that it came from, if it worked in something.
There's a lot of talk in the media at the moment about ultra-processed foods and how bad they are for the body. And whenever I read about this, I think about de-alcoholised wines, which are extremely processed.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about whether the heavy processing of alcohol or wine in this way has any health implications?
It's a hard one. You're always going to, when you de-alcoholise a wine, you are always going to be removing more than the alcohol. And that's why there are very few de-alkalized wines in the marketplace that are truly, truly palatable or comparable to a non-de-alkalized wine, because you've got to add back in things that are stripped out. And, they have worked very hard on procedures to not strip so much out, but it is hard. So you do have to add things back in to make it balanced and whatever else. Look, there is a market for people that truly can't have alcohol-containing products. I wouldn't call it a synthetic wine or anything like that. You are removing something. You're removing a couple of things. You then put other things back in that have been removed, which you can do in the hot one system, depending on, there are different ways of doing it, so you can put things back in. Technology has improved significantly over the last 25 years in how to do this. So we are seeing improvements all the time in the quality of these products. There is a definite need for them. I wouldn't call them ultra refined. The basic idea is simply to remove the alcohol.
Well, so here's the thing. So I've been through the last 6 or 7 months of trying most of the non-alcoholic wines on the marketplace, and I've done all sorts of things. I've added tonic water to them. I've added non-alc, spirit substitutes and all sorts of things. One of the things that I found is that I get lots of gastric problems after drinking them. And I went online to forums and found that a lot of other people were experiencing gas and abdominal distress after consuming them. And I was just wondering, if there's any reason for that. And it does occur to me that it is a very, I mean, I've been and I've had a look at how they do it through the spinning cone and stuff, and it is very, very heavily processed. I'm asking you to speculate, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. It is an interesting one. I think I may well have experienced that, because I have chronic gastritis anyway. So it may be related to the acidity, and there may be irritants that come to the forefront that may not necessarily be balanced out now because they're not in an alcohol medium. So the alcohol medium actually does change how the wine is absorbed and the ethanol is absorbed. So you would expect there will be an effect of the absorption of other components in the wine without the alcohol. But the irritant effect, when you talk about gas and that, it would be an irritant effect on the gastrointestinal lining, most likely. There's what you're experiencing, whether it's stomach or small intestine. So that would be my best guess.
That is very interesting. Okay, this is a good segue into the whole question of alcohol and health. So recently I interviewed Raymond Estruch, apologies if I got the name wrong, who ran the PreliMed study about the Mediterranean diet, and he told me that the alcohol is important in the diet for actually unlocking some of the polyphenols in the diet, like as in from olive oil, and that it is the alcohol itself that has some effect. What's your opinion about this?
Yeah, Ramon is correct. Professor Ramon Estruch, yes, he was part of, yeah, no, it's okay, it's pronunciation is hard, and it's Spanish, and yes, it is hard, but I know Ramon very well, and I know a lot about the PreliMed study. I was actually at the conference when the first wine data was announced by him, which was very exciting in relation to the pre-med. Yes, the ethanol is the important component for all alcoholic beverages. So, you know, beer, wine, spirits, we all have an alcoholic ethanol component, and that has proven biological effects on for cardiovascular disease and certain other degenerative diseases of ageing. But also we've got polyphenolic compounds, and the ethanol component actually facilitates the absorption of those polyphenolic compounds into the human body. So it is actually an important concept to have both together, because you've got the ethanol and then you've got the ethanol and the polyphenolic compounds in wine that act synergistically all together.
Yeah, I found that so interesting. Do you think, or do you know if there's any difference between alcohol from fermented products and alcohol from distilled products, or is it just all alcohol?
Oh, that is a very good question that no one's ever asked me before. that is a good one. There will always be, there have to be differences with the alcohol, ethyl alcohol. Yes, there would be differences. There would obviously be some commonality in alcohol, but, and there is commonality in the alcohol, but there will always be differences in the products, slight differences in the products as to all the alcohol-containing compounds, because there's so many. There are differences between beer, wine and spirits with respect to polyphenolic compounds in particular, but also there will be other nuanced differences between the products as well.
All right, let's talk about this. So you are part of the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research. Can you tell me about the background of that? How did that begin and why?
Okay, it's a group that formed in the early 2000s. It's a small fraternity, the alcohol and health and wine and health area, and really only research started in the 1990s when the Serge Renaults from France and the Arthur Klatskys from the US and the Kurt Ellisons from the US that were looking at changes, you know, with respect to data and their patients when it came to cardiovascular disease and some of the other diseases. So, there was a groundswell. Suddenly there was money around and research being done to try and understand it. And then, you know, it's hard when you've got concepts and ideas and then you get some people criticising it and some people will be doing a different study and seeing different ideas, and then how do you build on that and which one's right? So in the, as I said, in the mid-2000s probably, when we were starting to look at alcohol drinking guidelines because they actually are a relatively new phenomenon internationally, they've only been around about 30 years, there was so much misinformation that was coming out, and so a group of scientists got together, and it was started by Helena Conabair from the Alcohol Moderation Group. That's a movement that her father established, and then she took over the reins from, which was trying to look at the balanced scientific information. And so Kurt Ellison was very interested from Harvard University, an epidemiologist with a strong background in cardiovascular disease, that they formed this group of scientists, clinicians, epidemiologists that were actually looking at some of the papers, because suddenly you can imagine, you get a groundswell of research, you're going to get a groundswell of papers. And so how do you build on the knowledge base? So the group was started then to actually look at the papers, how well the studies were done and whether the results were then accurately drawn, and then how did these results fit in with other results from other studies. So this is how the group started. And it was like-minded scientists just trying to understand and get to the truth of the science. Not interested in politics. It was all about the science.
So if I understand you correctly, it sounds like there was a time when there was excitement about alcohol research and there was a lot going on. Because what people are telling me now is that there's under no circumstances can you get a grant to study alcohol in the context of health unless you are looking for negative findings. So what changed?
Oh, that's a good one. I think there were some papers. There were some papers that came out in the mid-2000s that were looking more statistically at the data and said, no, if you statistically analyse the data in this way, you don't see a J-shaped curve. And it was more about the negative effects that became into dominance rather than any potential positive effects. So, people started statistically analysing things in different ways. They were totally ignoring the biological data, which had really mushroomed in the 1990s, and they were simply looking at the number crunching and to get ideas. And it sort of evolved when it came to alcohol guidelines. I think some of it came out of wanting to reduce some of the alcohol-related harms that were suddenly being calculated and seen in society, or maybe they were actually being quantified. So I think there were some very conscientious researchers who decided, we don't want to make the message very good. We want to keep it in the bounds. We don't want people to think, if a little bit's good, they should drink more. So let's see. And I think it may have well started with that sort of ethos, and it has just gone on the momentum now, and it has become almost like a science on its own. So, there are certain groups that work together that have mainly a temperance background.
Well, it's true. They do. Let's be clear about that.
Temperance background. Even though I know some of them do drink and they freely admit that they drink, there's a temperance background that's there. And I suppose, it's also cultural. You look at the European countries of, Italy, Spain, France, where it is very cultural. And then you've got the cultural aspects of the northern countries where it's not so much wine in moderation, it's more spirits in large amounts. Then you've got in the USA, you've got differences again because it's very multicultural. Canada, again, there are differences because it's very multicultural. In Australia, we were sort of more the European model, but now we also more multicultural because you've got to look at a lot of Asian and Middle Eastern countries where it is, culturally not acceptable to drink. So it's become something that started out very simply as being related to culture. It's sort of become very muddy as alcohol has, spread throughout all these countries in society.
Are you talking here about drinking guidelines? Are you talking here about research?
Both. Drinking guidelines very much. I think that's been, when I look back at it and I look back at how the research, well, the guidelines followed the research and then, it's sort of grown on top of each other. And I know that when a lot of the Middle Eastern and Asian countries that did not have a culture of drinking alcohol were really concerned about the harms that were occurring when products were allowed to be consumed in their countries and they started to see alcohol-related health problems, that they did actually go to the WHO and say, we need help. And I think it's sort of spiralled from there. I don't think it's not one or the other. I think it's a sort of a mishmash along the way that one's fed on the other.
When was this?
Right. In the 1990s, it was all pretty much positive apart from a few dissenters. And again, that comes back to epidemiological studies and how they're done and all of that. You can have two epidemiological studies, but depending on how they're statistically analysed, you can actually get different results. Then in the late 1990s, it was still J-shaped curve was acceptable and people were quite happy about it. And then there were a couple of papers that came out that said, well, look, you know, you're looking at apples and bananas and oranges here. You know, if you take out people that don't drink or given up because they're sick and they've had to stop drinking, you know, what is your baseline measure? So they're saying, well, you really muddied it up here, people that have drunk too much and caused themselves health problems, so they've stopped drinking because they're sick, and you're lumping them in with people that have always chosen not to drink, and you're going to get different physiology here, and so therefore we don't think it's an appropriate baseline to use. So
I'm just going to stop and explain to listeners what we're talking about. The J-shaped curve was always observed in observational studies of yes. populations, which is the epidemiological studies we're talking about,
yes.
that people who drank moderate amounts of alcohol did better in all-cause mortality than people who either drank a lot or who never drank. And so what the people critiquing the J-curve are saying is that researchers didn't properly account for these people who never drank, and that there's no biological plausible mechanism why drinking a little bit should make you, you know, live longer than somebody who never drank. And so probably the reason that these abstainers have worse health outcomes is because they weren't drinking because they were sick. They're called sick quitters. Is that a fair summary?
That is, put it beautifully, Felicity. I'm sorry I couldn't be quite so eloquent myself. That's a problem sometimes when you're right in the middle of a field. It's very hard to be as eloquent as you put it together. But that's correct.
But there, as I understand it, there have been a number of researchers who have accounted for the sick quitter effect. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Arthur Tlatsky in particular then went back and looked at all his data, and he's had data back to the 1960s. He had a cohort. He was a very eminent cardiologist who died last year. And Arthur went back and looked at all his data and recalculated and still saw a J-shaped curve. And he wasn't the only one to go back and do that. So quite a lot of people did, and then people from probably the mid-2000s started to design their studies so that they did break it down into never drinkers, sick quitters and whatever else, and the baseline became never drinkers. And this is why we are still very confident now that we've changed our baseline. So papers pretty much all on from the mid-2000s are fine. You know, they have a clean baseline on which to base the curve and to compare.
Some of the studies which have come out and said you didn't properly account for the sick quitter effect. I mean, let's name here. We're talking about Tim Stockwell, Tim Namai, and their colleagues from the University of Victoria in Canada. And they've had huge media attention. The first paper came out in 2006 and yes. there was a second paper around 2012,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
And the last one came out in 2023. And there's been a summary of the paper which came out in the Journal of Addiction in June 2024, which has had a huge media effect. Now, my understanding is, first of all, that these papers are pretty similar. It's not new research every time. It's building on the one paper. Is that
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. The ones from about 2016 onwards, very much building on the same research and just different nuances with statistical analyses, whether you have more papers in or not, or, you know, I know that they said that they were ISFA put in a critique, and they then tried to address some of the issues that we had with their 2023 paper in their latest iteration. But it's still the same research. It's a slightly different inclusion of studies and statistical analyses.
Now that I've named names, let's get into the fight. So ISFA wrote some scathing critiques of these papers, and in response, the authors of the other papers wrote back to, I think, one of the journals and said, well, you guys are all industry shills. You've all taken money from the alcohol industry, and, of course, you would say that. What's your response to that? And actually, let's talk about conflicts of interest, because before we started recording, you were saying something very interesting about where research money comes from. And can you talk to that?
Yeah, happy to talk to that. Traditionally, and unless you have a proof of concept of research that, you know, your idea, whatever it might be to look at, is actually going to work, you're not going to get funding from government or university or any other groups. So industry, going back when it was acceptable, were then often a very handy place to go to and say, look, I've got this idea. I can't get, you know, the $500,000 I need from the federal government for funding until I can show that there's a very good chance that it's actually going to work and will, you know, have a beneficial effect. So the industry, whether it be food, alcohol, whatever else, would then say, okay, here's some what we call seed funding for proof of concept, and then if you can prove the concept works, then, you know, you go to government or whoever else then for the funding to do the very big studies. So that's how industry and academia became involved. And that's, you know, in pharmaceutical industry, because I used to work in pharmaceutical industry, so that's pharmaceutical. And I've also worked in research, so I've worked with you know, both sides of the fence here. And pretty much that's how it works. You have to have a proof of concept because, you know, why would the government give you money over somebody else if there was no likelihood something was going to work? And so that's how often the industry, you know, started things that then took momentum off. Now, we've got a lot less alcohol and health research going now because government won't fund it, and industry have been put, you know, a light has been shone on industry with a conflict of interest, which I can understand potentially here. So therefore, they're not comfortable funding. And then so then realistically, there's less government funding because there's less proof of concept, and so it goes on. But it's very, very hard.
Interesting. I spoke last year to Ken Mukamal about this, who, for listeners, he was the person behind a big randomised controlled trial that was cancelled. And he said, we know less about alcohol, which is this ancient drug, than we do about biologics that were created 5 years ago.
Correct.
That actually we don't really understand alcohol very well.
No, that's absolutely true. And going back to conflict of interest, there's just one thing. When you did have a relationship with a funding body, there are so many checks and balances and caveats that they will not be allowed to look at the data, manipulate the data, or interfere in the data in any other way. So it's all very, very tightly managed to have to reduce any conflicts of interest. And no, Ken's very correct, because since the early 2000s, it has been so difficult to get any pure biological research done or any main studies like the one that Ken was trying to pull together, you know, with Romanus Trush, you know, it was going to be the Netherlands, Italy, Spain, other countries, Australia. We were looking at another arm there to try and get a groundswell to simply understand the epidemiology on a huge population, to look at cultural differences then. We were all going to have very similar strict guidelines and dietary monitoring and all of that. So they would have given you a lot more weight of understanding of where your product is, that then you can then go from that basis to do more research. So we've got to a stage with our research where we really need to do what we would call human studies.
Yeah.
That's the top pinnacle, the golden standard is human study. And that's what we need to do. And that is not without risk. And that the PREDIMED study, did Ramon actually tell you that the PREDIMED study stopped prematurely because the difference in the three groups was so significant that they thought that the others, where they were in the not doing as well group, were actually at a human disadvantage, and therefore they ceased the study because they had
results. No, he didn't tell me that. Could you explain a bit further what you mean? What were the three groups?
Okay, there were three different dietary groups. I'm going from memory here. There were three different dietary groups. One included extra olive oil, one included extra nuts, and so they were, and then you had a low-fat diet, and then there was another component in there. And they could see that the Mediterranean, which included wine, with the nuts and olive oil, the people doing that was doing so much better with respect to their health, significantly better than those on the other diets. So therefore, they ethically, they could not continue the study. Although it was still, you know, it was still within the bounds, ethically they felt obliged to cease the study. They had a lot of data, been going for quite a while, but that was it.
Since I spoke to him, I've changed two things about my diet. One is I add lots of olive oil, which I never liked the taste of, but now I've learned to use it. And the other thing is I've stopped drinking alcohol by itself. If I have alcohol, I always have it with food now, which before I did, you know, I was quite happy to drink without food, but that has changed. Well, there are other forms of evidence that alcohol isn't great for you. One of them is Mendelian randomization. What's your thought about some of those studies? Listeners, her face crumpled. She cringed.
Okay, it's a useful tool, but it is not the only tool. Let me put it this way. And it's still in its infancy understanding how to use it and explain it. So a tool, but not the only tool. So Mendelian may show something that will either confirm or conflict with an outcome that you've seen previously. You've got to understand where it works here. And you just, and this is what frustrates me with studies, and it was one of the main reasons that the ISPA group formed. You know, just because you've got a new study out that says negative things or positive things, that doesn't discount everything that's gone before. And this is what I find with people that look at Mendelian randomization. Yes, it's a useful tool, but it doesn't tell you everything. It's not the be all or an end all, and it doesn't negate what's gone before.
Krina, can you tell us what Mendelian randomization is? Oh, cringing again.
Yes, it's not an easy concept for someone who's not a geneticist, even though I did genetics at university. I've always found it challenging. It is looking at basic genetics, and that comes down to how well you there are seven different forms of one type of enzyme and five different types of a form as to how you will you break down alcohol and its breakdown product. There are other enzymes in the body that are genetically controlled that will also have aspects related to health. So your personal genetics do make a difference, and this is where Mendelian randomization comes in, and how, you know, there are groups of people that will behave differently because of their genetics, and trying to put that into to balance. That's a basic way of trying to explain it.
So when Stockwell and Amy responded to your criticisms by criticising your industry links and so on, one of the things they said, which I thought was actually interesting, was they said there's no biologically plausible mechanism for alcohol to have as many benefits from helping with birth defects to kidney cancer to, you know, whatever, to dementia. What do you think about that? I mean, I just want to put a caveat on that. You know, if you look at alternative medicine, for example, you quite often find that people will claim, you know, one thing has miraculous properties across many, many different physical functions. And it is always a red flag when you say, you know, this substance can do these multiple things. And actually it is almost claimed that wine can do magical things across multiple parts of the body, from the immunology to cardiovascular to whatever. I mean, what do you think?
Interesting thought. No, I think alcohol has health harms and health benefits. I don't think you can ignore the health harms, but it comes down to a matter of dose. I don't believe it is a cure-all. It is effective in certain medical conditions. We know that there are very sound biological mechanisms for the cardiovascular system, for example. We know it from epidemiology and also from some limited human studies that for certain cancers, alcohol can actually have a beneficial effect, which is interesting in itself.
Kidney.
Yeah, also some of the blood cancers. It's fascinating. And we're still trying to understand the mechanisms where it comes into play there. But we know, for example, in breast cancer, it is more harmful than good. And there are direct mechanisms that are different to the other cancers. But, you know, if you're going to talk about cancers, not all cancers are the same. They are all different. Mm. So we've got biological mechanisms for some, but not everything. And we cannot prove the alcohol industry cannot prove that it is a magic cure. It has harms and benefits, and that is related to dose. If you're going to look at liver cancer, for example, there's threshold effects. Low amounts of alcohol are not going to increase your risk, is when you get into the higher amounts of alcohol. The same for cardiovascular disease. Low to moderate amounts of alcohol have beneficial effects, but you get negative effects and health harms, as we like to call them. When you go above moderation, you start to see the negative effects of alcohol on the body and directly on the organs and cells. So it really is like any medicine. There is like a threshold effect. You know, your doctor doesn't say take 3 pills a day neatly spaced out for no reason. He says that because that is what you call your therapeutic effect will actually fall when you get a blood level between, you know, those different doses. Too much, you'll get an adverse effects. Too little, you won't get any beneficial effects. So this is, and I hate using that analogy because alcohol is not a medicine. Make that absolutely clear. It is a lifestyle choice, nothing to do with medicine. I find that abhorrent. But it can be added in as a lifestyle adjunct. And we see that there are studies that look at lifestyle behaviours and increasing your, or decreasing, I should say, your risk of all-cause mortality and longevity, increasing your longevity. And alcohol, independently as well as collectively, is one of those 5 or more lifestyle factors when drunk in moderation.
When the WHO came out and said there's no safe level, on what basis were they saying that?
Well, there's no safe level for pretty much anything. It's all risk related, and it depends on what risks are acceptable to you. So safe is a very difficult term, and it does simply come down to risk. And what sort of risk you're looking at. There's a risk of driving a car. There's a risk of eating different foods. There's a risk of different sports. It's what you're prepared to accept as an acceptable risk that comes down to now, the relevance of that. No, for some people, no alcohol is definitely the safest thing for them, related to their biology, whether it be their psychology or their physiology. Okay, you know, we are aware that some people are more sensitive to the psychological effects and the brain biological effects of alcohol than other people. So you've got to put that into, you know, to concept there and context. But it all becomes about acceptable risks that you are prepared to take. And it's a case with guidelines about informing people, yes, there will be a risk. But the risk, if you put it into context with these other risks, you know, are you prepared to take that? Because that's, you like drinking alcohol, but you're aware that if you drink more than, you know, a certain amount, you are going to increase your risk of certain things, whether it be cancer or this or that or whatever else. So, you know, I agree. There is no safety. Safety is a term that was initially coined in the 1990s. That then came down to no risk and then came down to low risk. And that's really what it sits at, low risk.
So as you know, the US is currently revising its drinking guidelines. The German Nutrition Society came out last week and said they recommended no alcohol in a country that's famous for brewing and winemaking. If you had to set the drinking guidelines, where would you set them?
It depends what you set your guidelines on. And different countries will set guidelines based on different things. It will base them on the culture of the country as well as biology and science, as well as politics. There's always an element of politics there. I believe the guidelines should inform people. I believe that guidelines should be very simple. I believe that amount and pattern of consumption is important. And I believe that there are also gender differences in how well alcohol is dealt with by males and females. There are differences, most definitely, because sensitivity of women's organs is known to be far greater to the negative effects of alcohol. compared to men's. So the data suggests on average, and you have to say on average, that two standard drinks will have beneficial effects, one to two, depending on the person. And this is on average, the average punter in the street, one to two, when you go on a daily basis. Okay, so you can keep your blood alcohol level at a lower now, and with food is the right way to drink. So you're going to keep your blood alcohol concentration in your, dare I say, your safe level. You're not going to be going into your adverse effect range, because with food it slows down the absorption and it reduces your blood alcohol concentration, because the blood then goes into the alcohol then goes into your bloodstream much more slowly with food. So you're not going to see the dramatic highs that you would if you just drink on an empty stomach. So I think that's an important caveat and pattern. You don't want to binge drink. And you don't, yeah. Mm. So that's putting your blood alcohol concentration at an extremely high level for a longer period of time, because you only break down one drink an hour until you can then switch, because you've got two different metabolizing systems in the liver. One occurs all the time, and one is what we call concentration dependent, where you have to have a certain amount of alcohol in your body before that kicks in. But still, you don't want to have a high circulating concentration of alcohol for a long period of time to actually initiate some of the negative effects on the body.
So would you agree then that the current guidelines, which are so one a day for women and two a day for men, is roughly correct?
I'd say roughly correct. But this is for the average person. I'd say roughly correct. Probably say one to two for women and two to three for men. But two, if you just generally said two to make the message simple, two per day, I think is fine.
All right. Any final thoughts on, particularly now, the alcohol and health debate?
The debate should not be based on politics. It should be based on a sound understanding of the biology of a product. Like, we started off talking about additives and processing aids and toxicology and how they affect the body. We've sort of forgotten a bit about that when it comes to alcohol. I think other things have come into play more. We've lost the basis. The basis, when we first looked at guidelines in the 1990s, and Australia was one of the first countries to pull them together, it was all based on the science and how it worked. And we did some excellent, excellent pharmacological studies around to give us an understanding. We've lost that basis now. We're now looking much more about the politics and the culture of drinking and other things without really increasing our knowledge of how alcohol works in the body, and even potentially finding more negative effects or more positive effects that can be then used in other types of medicine. It's all about the science, and this is what we have forgotten. It's not proving that there's no risk or low risk. It's got to be about understanding the science and putting it into context there.
All right. On that note, thank you so much for your time, Karina. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Felicity. A pleasure.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.